We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Godspeed, John Glenn.
Roger, 0G, and I feel fine.
Get my feet out. Okay, I'm out.
How does it feel for the United States to be the new record holder?
At last, huh?
When that baby lights, there's no doubt about it.
Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
Listen, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Hello and welcome. This is Michael Annis, and you're listening to episode 105 of the Space Rocket History Podcast. And now, the first Saturn launch, SA-1, Part 2. Recapping from the previous episode, the first Saturn SA-1 has been delivered to the Cape from Huntsville, Alabama, by barge. The fully functional first stage, S-1, and the dummy upper stages have been erected on the launch pad. It is August 1961. Andrew Pickett's Vehicle and Missile Systems Group spent the next month installing the accessories of the SA-1 and conducting a series of launch vehicle tests. The purpose of the test was to make sure that various components responded correctly to pressure stimuli. The remainder of Pickett's group checked for leaks caused by the barge trip and the subsequent erection of the S-1 stage. The first week, the group performed pressure switch functional tests, verifying the pickup and dropout pressures for several hundred switches. Then the Saturn's 48 nitrogen bottles were tested at one-half the operating pressure. The purpose of the nitrogen bottles was to pressurize the RP-1 kerosene fuel tanks during flight. During the second week, Pickett's group checked out the pressurized and venting capability of the liquid oxygen tanks. When air pressure was applied to a switch in the tank's electrical system, the switch, when functioning properly, would terminate pressurization at a certain level. If excess pressure built up, a second switch would vent the gaseous oxygen. Next, the liquid oxygen and RP-1 system leak checks were performed. In both tests, the team pressurized the tanks to about one-half the operating pressure, looking for seal links. Concurrently, the remainder of Pickett's group conducted a series of engine tests. First, they performed a low-level nitrogen purge of the liquid oxygen dome located at the top of the H-1 engine. The purge begun prior to propellant loading and continued until shortly before engine ignition. The purge served several purposes. Since the nitrogen exceeded atmospheric pressure, it prevented contaminants from entering the thrust chamber nozzle and flowing up to the injector plate and liquid oxygen dome. The purge also prevented moisture from condensing in the area. If a launch was canceled, a full-flow nitrogen purge would quickly expel all liquid oxygen from the dome to avoid a possible explosion. Similar purges were also performed on the liquid propellant gas generator, liquid oxygen injection manifold, and the fuel injector manifold of the thrust chamber. Once again, these purges were performed to prevent the entry of unwanted substances. On September 6th, the full tank pressurization test was performed. Since there was a possibility of an explosion while bringing the launch vehicle to full pressure, Launch Operations Directorate officials cleared the pad for the Wednesday morning test. The two-hour exercise went smoothly, and that afternoon, engineers were back at the launch vehicle for further operations. Now, this next section of checkout is dedicated to the instrumentation and electrical engineers in the audience. Calibration of the measuring devices that were to report more than 500 flight measurements was a daily operation. Sensing devices such as transducers, potentiometers, thermocouples, and strain gauges measured pressures, propellant flows, temperature, and vibration. A signal from one of these sensors, measured in millivolts, was routed to a signal conditioner which amplified the reading until it could be read on a scale of 0.5 volts. The calibration of these signal conditioners, popularly referred to as black boxes, was a major concern of Reuben Wilkinson's measurement group. The teams sometimes simulated a sensing device by tapping on a portion of the rocket to cause vibrations, or by placing a hot soldering iron near a thermocouple. But most of the time, they simulated a signal with an electrical input through an interrupt box located between the sensor and the signal conditioner. The measuring group removed faulty instruments from the launch vehicle for further checks at calibration stands or in an instrument calibration laboratory. The team was also responsible for the blockhouse measuring station. Here, launch operations directive received 100 ground measurements on the rocket and ground support equipment, as well as telemetry data. Next, Daniel McMath's telemetry team checked out the booster's 8 RF links. 7 of the links used the old XO-4B package telemetry system from the Jupiter rocket flights. The XO-4B telemetry system had 15 channels of continuous data and 54 multiplex channels. The 8th telemetry link system was developed by the Guidance and Control Division in Huntsville to ensure sufficient data channels for the Saturn I because it sent much more telemetry back than the Jupiter rocket. The central feature in the new XO-6B telemetry system was a 216-channel electronic communication system. The system used multiplexers to continuously sample 216 sensors and convert their reading into one output signal. The signal was broadcast over a radio to the control room, where it was demultiplexed back into the 216 separate sensor readings. So the 216 separate Saturn measurements traveled on only one radio frequency. Continuing with the checkout, McMath's telemetry group first tuned the two sets of antennas located at the forward end of the S1 stage. The six-man team next performed transmitter and power amplifier checks, tuned the frequency of the radio equipment, and verified the telemetry wiring. After all 8 telemetry links were checked out, the team reconnected the measuring and telemetry systems for subsequent tests of the launch vehicle. During the first month of checkout, Jim White's tracking group worked on the tracking system for the SA-1, which involved cameras, radio, radar, and telemetry. The radar systems were controlled by the Air Force. The S-band radar provided position data by tracking the Saturn beacon. The C-band radar was a backup if the Saturn beacon failed. The telemetry employed 2 baselines. One set of antennas located south of Launch Complex 34 determined whether the rocket made its proper turn out to sea. The other set, southwest of Launch Complex 34, ascertained flight path deviations downrange. Moving on, at the midway point in the 8-week checkout, the scheduling committee planned a radio frequency compatibility test. This was a significant test for SA-1 because it was the first time the vehicle stood alone with the service structure removed from the pad for a complete check of the radio systems. Power was applied to the vehicle's radio systems to transmit signals to Cape receiving stations for telemetry, radar, and command and control. The launch team was particularly interested to see if the test would cause any interference in the self-destruct system. Earlier launch programs had involved 2 or even 4 telemetry links. SA-1's 8 telemetry links increased the possibility of radio signal interference that might introduce spurious signals to activate the self-destruct system. Fortunately, the compatibility test served as both a validation and a confidence function, proving each radio channel's performance and demonstrating that no serious interference would enter the destruct system. And there was an unexpected bonus. The test also demonstrated the launch vehicle's stability. Shortly after removal of the service structure, a sudden September storm subjected the rocket to 48 km/h winds with no ill effects. In the fifth week of checkout, Launch Operations Directorate started integrated systems test. Overall test number one was the first run of the launch vehicle's sequencing system, which was the relay logic that controlled the last minutes of the countdown. This test was successfully completed. Overall test number two, called a plugs dropped test, which meant the vehicle would use its internal power with ground support disconnected. This test was also successful. Overall test number three was the most important. It pulled all systems together in a check, verifying the previous 5 weeks' work. The launch team began preparations for the test Saturday, September 23rd. The advanced work fell into seven categories: vehicle networks, ground networks, mechanical, electrical support, measuring, radio frequency, and navigation. Vehicle network requirements included the connection and verification of telemeters, calibrators, radars, and 60 test cables. Overall test number three, conducted on Monday morning, went well. Officials were increasingly confident that SA-1 would fly. By early October, the original launch date of the 12th had slipped 8 days. On October 4th, the launch team conducted the liquid oxygen loading test, a major exercise for SA-1 since it represented the first integration of the CAPE's cryogenic support equipment with the Saturn vehicle. Launch Operations Directive followed this successful exercise with another plugs drop test on the 10th. Engine swivel checks were completed by the end of the week. The launch team began the ninth week of checkout with the simulated flight test, the last major pre-flight test. The test went well, but officials delayed the launch another week while they debated the merits of adding more sensors near the base of the booster to provide additional information on the critical bending during the first 35 seconds of the flight. But it was finally decided that SA-1's instrumentation was adequate and the launch was set for October 27th. During the last week, Launch Operations Directorate personnel installed the ordnance for the self-destruct system and then repeated the simulated flight test. And now we can finally move on to the launch. No previous maiden launch had gone flawlessly, and the Saturn C-1 was considerably more complicated than earlier rockets. Launch Operations Directorate officials gave the rocket a 75% chance of getting off the ground and a 30% chance of completing the 8-minute flight. Although the odds on a pad catastrophe were not quoted, launch officials acknowledged their vulnerability. With the construction of Launch Complex 37 barely begun, a pad explosion could delay the Saturn program a year. Critics had questioned the wisdom of the clustered booster design. Propellant pumps were supposedly reaching design limits, and the Saturn C-1 had 16 pumps in 8 engines. Some experts derisively referred to the SA-1 launch as Cluster's last stand. Saturn backers were expressing confidence in the rocket, but concern about its launch effects. During test firings at the Redstone Arsenal, residents 12 kilometers away had reported shattered windows and earth tremors. Pre-launch preparation began at 7 a.m. on October 26, 1961. Mechanical office tasks that morning included inspection of the high-pressure gas panel, cable mast, and fuel mast, ordnance installation, and preparation of the hold-down arms. At 12:30 p.m., Thomas Pantoliano's 12-man propellant section checked out the RP-1 kerosene fuel facility, while Andrew Pickett's team pressurized the helium bottle. RP-1 loading began an hour later. The propellant team filled the launch vehicle's tank to the 10% level using a slow manual procedure of approximately 750 liters per minute to check for leaks, and they found one. A leak in the fuel mass vacuum breaker was easily repaired, and at 2:30 p.m., the launch team cleared the pad for automatic fast fill operation. Fuel now flowed into the launch vehicle at a rate of 7,570 liters per minute, reaching the 97% level in about 35 minutes. The propellant team then reverted to the slow fill procedure. As the design of the Saturn included a fuel drainage system, Pantoliano's crew placed 103% of the required RP-1 aboard the Saturn. Just before launch, the propellants team would take a final density reading and drain sufficient kerosene to achieve the desired fuel level. The 10-hour countdown started at 11 p.m. as Launch Complex 34 switched to the Cape's emergency generating plant. This facility supplied the launch team a current relatively free of fluctuations common in commercial power. The Saturn's electrical circuits and components began warming up when vehicle power was applied at T-minus 570 minutes before launch. 5 minutes later, the measuring panel operator turned on the 8 telemetry channels. A series of calibration checks followed. At T-minus 510 minutes, range and launch officials initiated an hour of radar checks. Loading of the liquid oxygen started at 3 a.m. on the 27th, T-minus 350 minutes. The Saturn's liquid oxygen tanks were 10% filled to check the tanks for leaks in the launch vehicle or in the 229-meter transfer line, as well as to pre-cool the line for the fast flow of the supercold liquid oxygen. The 10% level in the Saturn's tanks was maintained for the next 4 hours by feeding liquid oxygen from the 49,000-liter replenishing tank. Testing of command and communication system began at T-minus 270 minutes. The flight control panel operator activated the guidance system's stabilized platform to check pitch, roll, and yaw responses. 10 minutes later, the network panel operator placed the vehicle on internal power to ensure that the Saturn's batteries functioned properly. Meanwhile, other engineers conducted radar and telemetry checks. Operation was over by T-minus 255 minutes and the launch vehicle was returned to external power. Then, 2 hours from the 9 a.m. scheduled liftoff, an unfavorable weather report prompted launch officials to call a hold. But conditions improved and the count resumed at 7:34 a.m. Next, the launch team rolled the service structure back to its parking area, 180 meters from the rocket. The propellants team set up the liquid oxygen facility for fast fill at T-minus 100 minutes. The order to clear the pad came 20 minutes later. The blockhouse doors swung shut at T-minus 65 minutes. 1 hour from launch, the pad safety officer gave his clearance and the propellant team initiated a 6.5-minute pre-cool sequence, a slow fill to re-cool the main liquid oxygen storage tank line, which had not been used for several hours. When the pre-cool was completed, the light flashed on and the liquid oxygen facility's pump began moving 9,500 liters per minute into the Saturn. In 30 minutes, the tanks were 99% full. Liquid oxygen loading changed over to the replenish system. An adjust level drain had already been made on the RP-1 kerosene tanks, bringing the fuel level down to 100%. Launch officials then became concerned that a patch of clouds over the Cape might obscure tracking cameras, so they called a second hold at 9:14 a.m. But soon a northeast breeze cleared the skies, and within half an hour the countdown resumed. During the last 20 minutes, the launch team made final checks of telemetry, radar, and the command network. Away from the launch complex 34, Cape watchers gazed uncertainly at the Saturn rocket as the countdown neared completion. The launch team had set up panels and microphones at the Cape to register the Saturn's shock and sound waves. At the press site, 3 kilometers from Pad 34, reporters were issued earplugs as a precautionary measure. Launch Operations Directorate officials had assured local residents that fears of the rocket were exaggerated. Still, everyone wondered what it would be like. Automatic countdown operations commenced at T-minus 364 seconds. The onboard sequencer took control. It monitored tank, hydraulic, and pump pressures, ordered a nitrogen purge of the engine compartment, and closed the liquid oxygen tank vents to pressurize the liquid oxygen. At T-minus 35 seconds, SA-1 switched to internal power. 10 seconds later, the sequencer ejected the long cable mast. At T-minus 5 seconds, the pad flush command began a flow of water around the launcher's base. At that time, a number of possible malfunctions, a premature commit signal, insufficient thrust in one or more engines, rough combustion, short mass failure, detection of fire, or voltage failure, could still cause the automatic programmer to terminate the countdown. The moment of truth came at 10:06 a.m. Contrary to popular belief, no one pushed the firing button to send SA-1 on its way. Launch came when the sequencer ordered the firing of a solid propellant charge. The gases from the ignition of the charge accelerated a turbine that in turn drove fuel and liquid oxygen pumps. Hydraulic valves opened, allowing RP-1 and liquid oxygen into the combustion chambers, along with a hypergolic fluid that ignited the mixture. The engines fired in pairs, developing full thrust in 1.4 seconds. A final rough combustion check was followed by ejection of the liquid oxygen and RP-1 fuel mass from the booster's base. The 4 hold-down arms released the rocket 4 seconds after ignition. SA-1 was airborne. Spectators saw a lake of flame, felt the rush of a shockwave, and then heard the roar of the 8 engines. Trailer windows at the viewing site shook in response to the Saturn's power. Yet for many thousands watching the launch, the roar was a letdown. Reporters thought the sound equaled an Atlas launch viewed at half the distance. The Miami Herald headline the next morning read, "Saturn blast quieter than expected." Although the Saturn's roar failed to meet expectations, the human noise at Launch Complex 34's control center was impressive. A NASA information officer told reporters that when the rocket passed max Q, which was the greatest point of aerodynamic pressure, at about 60 seconds into the flight, everyone in the blockhouse celebrated. The flight itself was nearly perfect. The rocket reached a height of 137 kilometers and impacted 346 kilometers downrange from the launch site in the Atlantic Ocean. The only minor problem was the rocket cut off 1.6 seconds ahead of schedule. This was traced to the fact that there was 400 kilograms too much liquid oxygen and 410 kilograms too little RP-1. Hours later, at a press conference, Kurt DeBoos's face reflected the happy sense of accomplishment when he informed the press that it had been nearly a perfect launch. The success was particularly welcome to the Kennedy administration, coming at a time of high tension between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. The raising of the Berlin Wall had stunned the Western world in August of 1961. President Kennedy had responded with a partial mobilization of U.S. reserve forces, but most political analysts considered the events a Russian victory. In late October, as the Soviet Union prepared to test a 50-megaton hydrogen bomb, President Kennedy had proposed a massive fallout shelter program. On the day of the SA-1 launch, Russian tanks moved into East Berlin for the first time in several years. The space race was an important element in a Cold War that threatened to turn hot. With the success of the Saturn booster, the U.S. had achieved a launch capability of 1.3 million pounds of thrust. Space reporters were quick to point out the limits of the American success. The Soviet Union already had workable upper stages for their first stage. Furthermore, the current Russian test in the Pacific would likely result in sizable booster advances. Despite these caveats, commentators agreed that SA-1 was an important step toward a lunar landing. Salutations from the foothills of North Carolina. This is Michael Annis, your host, and I wanted to say thanks for listening to episode 105 of the Space Rocket History Podcast entitled Saturn's First Flight, SA-1 Part 2. Space Rocket History is a proud member of the History Podcasters and the Tech Podcasting Network. Hope you enjoyed the episode. It was my pleasure to bring it to you. Want to give a big shout out to all my longtime listeners. Thanks for staying subscribed and extend a warm welcome to my new listeners. This episode made it very obvious that we're not using a Redstone, an Atlas, or even a Titan. This is a Saturn. What an impressive way to start the Saturn launches. An excellent launch and flight. I think the U.S. has a good booster here. Well, folks, I looked high and low and could not find any launch audio except for the sound of the engines at launch. And what you heard on the podcast there was the actual SA-1 launch, the sound of the engines. But I did find a video of the launch, and I posted that on the homepage at spacerockethistory.com. The video has several versions of the launch, and some of them are in slow motion. So make sure you check that out. This episode had a lot of technical details. I apologize if I bored you with the details. I was trying to convey the complexity of the Saturn and the level of detail that was required to check it out. It took 9 weeks to fully prepare it for launch. And only the first stage was active. The upper stages were dummies filled with water. There were 500 flight measurements from the first stage. It's only going to get more complex from here. Imagine what it will be like when the upper stages are installed and then the service and command modules. Now that's going to be some complications. Okay, we have now caught up the Saturn booster with the Apollo capsule, so we can continue to advance in the Apollo program next week. I posted some really good pictures for this episode and, of course, the video, so make sure you check them out at the homepage, spacerockethistory.com. And if you'd like to have those pictures emailed to you immediately after the podcast is complete, you can sign up for the email list on the homepage. It's on the right column of the page, and it is called Subscribe to Blog by Email. Or you can sign up for the RSS feed by clicking on the little orange box. Speaking of the RSS feed, if you ever have a problem with it not going back all the way to the first episode, in other words, not including all episodes, that's because FeedBurner has a limitation on how many past episodes that it will handle. So if you ever cannot find a episode by using the RSS feed, just go to the homepage. Click on the podcast archive and you will find all the episodes that I've done, all the way back to episode 1. Feel free to listen online or download. Before I begin the podcast business section, I want to recommend that you listen all the way to the end of the podcast. There's a little surprise in there. Sadly, I did not receive any donation to support the podcast this week. So, if you're enjoying the podcast, please consider donating to support the show. For your convenience, there are two methods to donate, on a one-time basis or through Patreon on a monthly basis. If you want to make a one-time donation, just click on the orange donate button on the homepage at spacerockethistory.com. A donation of $5 will get your name on the donor page at the Sputnik level. Vostok level is 10, Mercury 20, Soyuz 30, Gemini 40, Apollo 50, and Orion is 100. If you prefer to donate through Patreon on a monthly basis, there's a link to my Patreon page on the homepage below the orange donate button. I want to thank those who liked the Facebook page this week. We're now up to 520 likes. And thank those who have begun following me on Twitter. We're up to 260 followers. My Twitter handle is @SpaceRocketHist. And if you follow me, I will follow you back. Now, you may be asking yourself, why should I follow @SpaceRocketHist? That's because Facebook and Twitter are the tools I use to keep listeners up to date on podcast episodes. You will receive at least 3 tweets previewing the next episode per week. So I encourage you to like the Facebook page and follow me on Twitter. The links to Facebook and Twitter are also on the homepage, spacerockethistory.com. Should you need to contact me, my email address is mike@spacerockethistory.com. I want to encourage everyone to share the podcast. Feel free to link the homepage or a particular episode on all social media. And thanks to those who have already done so, like my retweeters, Jet City Star, Stephen Lebowski, Futurama King, Rocket Noob, Renz Loing, Pompeiator, 59ers, and Felix Cronlich. Hope to have episode 106 ready by next Thursday. And now, the surprise. In celebration of the successful SA1 launch, we're going to have a little bonus content. I've been trying to get this bit of content in for several weeks now, and I decided I'd just go ahead and put it in here. During the time that SA1 was being constructed, delivered, and launched, NASA Administrator Webb was making decisions on the numbers, kinds, and locations of the special facilities and real estate needed to launch men to the moon. Within the 5 months from June to October of 1961, 4 new installations, all in the Gulf Coast states, had been added to NASA's far-flung domain. We've already partially covered the facility at Cape Canaveral. I also wanted to quickly mention the role that Kurt DeBoos, the leader of NASA's launch operations, played in the facility's design and construction there. DeBoos developed plans for mobile launch operations facilities at the Cape, including the Vehicle Assembly Building, where the big boosters would be assembled vertically and checked out under protective cover, and then moved to the launch pad. DeBoos drew up plans for personnel buildup, construction contracts, and administrative autonomy. And on March 7, 1962, when Marshall's Launch Operations Directorate became NASA's Launch Operations Center, DeBoos was ready to put his plan into action. Now let's consider the facilities for the Accelerated Booster Development Program. In Huntsville, von Braun had his 6,000 employees housed in part of the Army Redstone Arsenal on the Tennessee River. Although it was adequate for engineering development and static testing of smaller rockets, the Marshall Center could not handle the immense vehicles planned for the lunar voyage. Von Braun would need land and facilities elsewhere, but he would also need to be able to access the navigable waters of the Tennessee Valley Authority. A survey of government-owned war surplus plants revealed one near St. Louis and another one named Machaud near New Orleans that were suitable for the building of the huge boosters. But the Mississippi River around St. Louis often froze over during the winter months. So Machaud, with a mammoth building that contained 0.17 square kilometers under one roof, and it was part of a 3.5 square kilometer complex along the water's edge, was selected on September 7, 1961. Designed as a shipyard, it had become a cargo aircraft factory in 1943 and a tank engine plant during the Korean conflict. Here, the Chrysler Corporation and the Boeing Company would construct the first stages of the Saturn C1 and later of the Saturn C3, C4, or C5, whichever model was chosen. Influencing the Machaud decision was the need for a test operations area nearby where acoustics could be managed and controlled, as well as logistics. Von Braun's team had always worried about the noise and vibrations generated during static testing, and so had the citizens of Huntsville, Alabama. As boosters became larger, they became louder, and their low-frequency resonance threatened all kinds of structural damage. Using statistics gathered from the Saturn C1 decibel and vibration levels, acoustics experts estimated that the advanced Saturn would require a much larger buffer zone. Marshall occupied only about 65 square kilometers of the more than 161 square kilometer Redstone arsenal, and the Army needed the rest of the land for its own rocket development and test programs. But even the whole expanse would not have been large enough for the superbooster. What NASA required was about 400 square kilometers. So large a purchase could be touchy if not properly handled. NASA officials worked through Congress while site survey teams operated through the executive branch and administrative channels on a gargantuan land deal not far from Machaud. On October 25, 1961, NASA announced that it would purchase outright 54 square kilometers in southwest Mississippi and obtain easement rights over another 518 square kilometers in Mississippi and Louisiana for the Big Booster static test site. Simultaneously, the Justice Department filed suits of condemnation under the law of eminent domain in the U.S. district courts in both states. The area, largely flat pine forest, was on the Pearl River, only 56 kilometers north of Machaud. Well suited to NASA's needs because of its deep water access and low density population, the Pearl River site was bought for about $18 million. While engineers at Marshall drew up specifications for static test stands, canals, and storage areas, nearly 100 families, including the whole community of Gainesville, Mississippi, had to sell out and relocate. But there were few complaints, as most of the residents were pleased at the prospect of new economic opportunities. Now let's move on to the location for the Manned Space Flight Center, which was also a touchy issue, with pressure from local groups trying to bring the Manned Space Flight Center to their location. To help with that situation, Ralph E. Ulmer and Paul G. Demling, facilities and legal expert at NASA headquarters, were saddled with most of the worries connected with the whirlwind activities of site scouting and selection for the Manned Space Flight Center. For example, Ames Research Center Associate Director John F. Parsons, who led the search for the Spacecraft Development Center, reported to Demling and Ulmer and no one else on the whereabouts of his team, and it its needs for advice and support. Webb, Dryden, and Siemens referred all inquiries to Dimly in an effort to avoid undue pressure from persons and groups trying to advance local prospects. On September 13th through 14th, 1961, Webb and Dryden reviewed all the factors in selecting the site for the Manned Space Flight Center and decided to move that NASA function to Houston. NASA announced the decision on September 19, 1961. Gilruth and his space task group would soon have a home of their own to manage a place in which to develop their payloads for future rockets. Webb called it the Command Center for the Manned Lunar Landing and Follow-on Manned Space Flight Missions, intimating that an integrated mission control center would also be located in the Houston area. But most Space Task Group people were Virginians, both native and otherwise, and they were not very happy over the prospects of transferring to Texas. But NASA's opportunities to accept a politically arranged gift of 4 square kilometers of salt grass pasture land was too good to refuse. Of course, there were the usual charges of undue political influence, largely from the areas that had been turned down. The fact that there were Texans in powerful political positions, like Vice President Johnson and Congressman Albert W. Thomas, the chairman of the House Independent Offices Appropriations Committee, provided much of the ammunition for a brief barrage of critical newsprint. Later, when NASA spent more than $1 million to acquire an additional 2 square kilometers, the accusations of special interest were revived. But the Houston area met all the technical criteria for the new center. The 7th and soon to be the 6th largest city in the country, Houston had the utilities, transportation, and weather, as well as all the cultural, academic, industrial, and recreational specifications. Webb knew that facilities and construction were critical to the success in landing on the moon during the 1960s. He called on the Army Corps of Engineers for assistance. Rather than face the costly and time-consuming struggle of staffing a NASA office for this one-time task, the Corps would be invaluable in acquiring land at both Merritt Island and Machild and in constructing new facilities at the Cape, at Machild, and at Houston. Webb asked Lieutenant General W.K. Wilson, Chief of Engineers, to join him in this enterprise almost as a partner. Okay, this concludes the bonus content for episode 105. I hope you enjoyed it, and so long for now.